This is a national landmark in the United States in the city of St. Louis. It's called the Arch. It carries historical significance because this is the place where a couple of explorers named Lewis and Clark launched through the Gateway, which is what the Arch stands for, to explore half of the country, which was acquired from France by Thomas Jefferson just prior to that time. I like historical landmarks, whether it's the Statue of Liberty, which people who come to the U.S. recall, especially for those immigrating, that they would come into New York Harbor and pass by because it was the new opportunity for them. Maybe there's other historical landmarks, like for whatever significance they may have, like the Eiffel Tower in Paris, Big Ben in London. Maybe there's other ones that are artistic that you know of, that you have appreciated, taken a lot of pictures of, and sometimes they're for destinations. There's historical landmarks that have history and a story behind them, like the pyramids in Egypt, or maybe the Colosseum in Rome, where there's stories behind that, and you're saying, wow, this is what happened during this particular time. Or Angkor Wat in Siem Reap, Cambodia, which is a remarkable archaeological ruin, but it also is still operational. Many times when we look at historical landmarks, like the Statue of Liberty, we appreciate them, wave at them, maybe thinking, thank you, pass by, and then out of sight and out of mind. Great for the past, but not necessarily relevant for the present. And many people treat Jesus like that. He is a wonderful historical landmark, someone who has a moral ethic that has imitated him. Mahatma Gandhi imitated him. Martin Luther King Jr. imitated him with his ethic of loving enemies rather than hating them. All of that. But that's as far as it went. And many people treat God like that, where they acknowledge him, but he is great for past, maybe for other people, but irrelevant for the present, and doesn't really shape and change anything because we've moved beyond him. I want us to see that you can't treat Jesus that way. And when you are following after him, he definitely is not a historical landmark. He is a present force that is changing you and does not leave you alone. I've entitled this message, Deepening Trust in the Lord, Stronger Faith in Crisis. We are dealing with another familiar story, a miracle, and we're parking two of them next to each other. And whenever a gospel writer does that, it means something, not just the story itself, but when you juxtapose them, when you put them next to each other, that itself is intentional, so that we're going to call attention to what point that the author of this, which is John, is making. We've all heard about the feeding of the thousands of the crowd. And during that challenge, there was a problem. But you know what? Philip and Andrew initially didn't know it. Jesus had to point it out to them. It wasn't a crisis, but it was a particular problem. There was a solution. And it was done with everybody that was there present, noticing and having a reaction to it. But now we're going deeper than that. Now we're looking at something where there is no crowd. It's just a few guys in a boat, and they're by themselves out in the middle of this lake, and it is a life crisis, because this boat could capsize and all of them would drown. They know that. This is a different situation altogether. This is a different type of test. And John is showing us that the disciples are being the focal point that Jesus is training, because he has limited time on earth and he's going to leave everything into their hands, but they aren't going to be alone. His spirit would be involved in them, and they're going to have to trust without him directly involved. And now's when we're starting that. And maybe this is the case with you today, where Jesus is moving beyond just someone who has been a historical interest to someone now who's either going to save me or I die, because I'm in the middle of a crisis. Not something I didn't really expect, but something that has happened all the same. Nobody else is around. It's just me and my God. John's not going to talk as much about walking on the water. We've all heard about that, and people can be skeptical of whether he did it, maybe how he did it. That's not the point John's bringing out. What he's bringing out is a crisis of life and the disciples, and what is Christ going to do about it? He's put them through one test, which was a challenge, but this is different. And sometimes we have variations of tests. Sometimes God allows us to go into something which is a problem. And sometimes there's one of which there's an emotional reaction. There could be panic here. This is different. And where is God now? That's what John wants us to bring out. I want to show you five different ways of which faith can grow in crisis that we'll see just in this brief passage, but the story is going to bring it out. It's part of our series in Believing in Christ. John tells us at the end of chapter 20 that these things have been written so that you might believe. I could write a lot more, but this is sufficient. It's like John's gospel is the best of Jesus. His greatest sayings, his greatest signs, these are sufficient so that you'll believe in him. If this doesn't do the job, nothing else will. This is sufficient for you, as John is writing to people with a religious background like the Jews and those with none like the Gentiles. Let's take a look at these things. First of all, deep and trust in the Lord involves great crisis. It can involve great crisis. Verse 16, when evening came, his disciples went down to the sea, got into a boat, and started across the sea to Capernaum. It was now dark. Jesus had not yet come to them. The sea became rough, and a strong wind was blowing. Note that when they went into the boat, they were getting away from the crowd. Jesus was himself in verse 15. He withdrew again to the mountain by himself. So the disciples are just going to, we know other gospels are going to say Jesus helped them in the boat, tell them I'll meet you at the other side. So everything's fine, okay? We just had an incredible time. Jesus just solved a problem. He fed thousands of people. This is a moment of great PR. This is a great time of promotion of who Christ is. The disciples, no doubt, are excited. The last thing on their mind is they're now about to go from an incredible high to an incredible panic low. Their lives might even be ended at this point. They're not thinking about that. They're getting into the boat. It's getting evening. It's a beautiful night. There's no storm. They head on out. Then the wind hits. Now, think about Galilee. If you've ever been to Israel, Galilee is positioned between mountains. So the winds that come down off of the hot desert plains from the Golan Heights to surrounding other areas come down with the coolness of the water, and those gusts can make the water turbulent in a hurry. You can have no warning. You don't necessarily see the storm coming. It's suddenly there. And in the boats they have are going to be fishermen boats. So they're going to be buoyant to a certain extent, but you got a lot of men in this boat. And so if the thing gets full of water because waves are splashing in and you're bailing out, the thing could capsize and all lives could be lost. It was risky doing fishing because of the unpredictability of the water itself. And so there's no crisis, and all of a sudden there is a crisis. Maybe they knew there was some danger, but there was nothing that was precipitating that when they got into the boat and headed on out. And the crisis didn't hit until later on. It says they're about 3 or 4 miles. Well, Galilee just happens to be about that 8 miles wide. So you're looking at the crisis doesn't hit until they're at the most vulnerable point right in the middle where they can't necessarily go back and forth. And with the storm and the waves coming, they're not able to navigate. It's like they're stuck in a riptide where they can't get out, they can't get in, they're stuck. What are we going to do? Sometimes we have crisis. We didn't anticipate them. Everything was fine. In fact, we may have had a spiritual high, and then we came down from our mountaintop experience, and then everything goes wrong. Do we still trust in Jesus, or is he only good to us when we're in the heights? Can I still follow after him when something I did not anticipate happening? A strong wind suddenly broadsides me, and now what am I supposed to do? This is not feeding a few people. This is saving my own life. Do I still trust him then? Will he help me? Now here's the second thing I want you to note. Deep and trust in the Lord may require isolation. Look at verse 17. They got into the boat, started across the sea. It was now dark, and Jesus had not yet come to them. John wants us to note, there's no Jesus here, and it's dark. It's dark, and the light of the world's not around. Where? He's on a mountain somewhere. Oh, the problem hits. Great. Where's Jesus when I need him? Where is God now in the middle of my storm, when I'm about to lose my life? And sometimes there's a deliberate delay. Jesus doesn't get in the boat with them. He doesn't rescue them out of the storm. He lets them struggle. We find in scriptures that some of the greatest tests of people of God happens in isolation. Daniel was alone in the lion's den. Abraham was alone when he was called to sacrifice his son. John the Baptist was alone in prison, that ultimately he was going to be executed. When Peter failed Jesus and he wept, he was alone when that happened. When Joseph was sold by his brothers and he was trying to follow God in a foreign country, he was all by himself as a youth. Job was alone. He alone suffered health and debilitating loss. He alone faced his criticizing friend. When Jacob wrestled with a man, he wrestled with him. It was the Lord. He wrestled with him alone. Sometimes the greatest work that God's going to do is when he has to get you alone, get you away from the crowds. There's nobody else around. It is dark and Jesus has not come to you yet. And that's what then pushes you to the edge. Either you're going to grow increasingly bitter towards him because he wasn't there, or you're going to hold on. That's when faith becomes real, because you got nothing else. You're in a storm, you're in a crisis that is threatening, and either God is real, he's going to rescue me, or he's not. And he's not doing it immediately. He's going to make you wait. One of my great heroes in church history is a man named Jonathan Edwards. Edwards was a pastor, scholar, philosopher in New England. And he pastored a very affluent church in a place called Northampton. And while he was there, even though he wasn't dynamic in his presentation with his preaching, his insights were profound. He's one who preached a memorable sermon called Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. And when he preached that, and other people like George Whitfield and others were around him, there was a true revival that broke out in that part of Massachusetts, in Boston area, called the Great Awakening. You found people that were repenting of sin and coming to church and getting their lives right with God. It was a profound historical movement of the Lord that didn't soon quit. But Edwards was a man of conviction. When he was a student at Yale, he wrote down a series of resolutions. So when he made a resolution, he had to stay by it. One of the resolutions he made was that he was going to stand up for Christ no matter what the cost. Well, even though he was popular and was part of this revival and the churches were growing, not just his, but others around him, he soon came into trouble with his own congregation because he was insisting upon people being converted to become members of the church and take the Lord's Supper. Well, they were so infuriated by that, they ultimately dismissed him. He got sacked. Well, now what is he going to do? He was blacklisted in many places. No churches were going to take him. Didn't matter what he had done. Bad reputation was being spread. Lies were being spread about him. He could not find a church. And ultimately, he found one church that was going to take him. But it was a remote, rural place in an outskirt post called Stockbridge. You can go there today. It's not an outpost anymore, but it was then. It was the end of civilization. That's where you had the threat of Indian attacks. Well, there were also a number of Indians who were believers there too, from the Mohawk tribe. That was the only church, so there he goes, takes his family, and here you have this well-to-do in the affluent church of Northampton, goes over, and he ministers to some ruffian settlers and Mohawk Indians who didn't speak English, so he had to learn, in his 40s, he had to learn Mohawk. And he does it. He's learning Mohawk. He's doing that. He's all by himself. All of the affluence and all of the wealth and all of that is left behind. He's got just a room full of mixed crowd. But there be God in his isolation. And we only know about Edwards because that's when he wrote all his books that have influenced numerous people for the past couple hundred years. Edwards' greatest moments were in his isolation. We know about Joseph because of his isolation. We know about Daniel because of what God did in him and through him when he was alone and put to the test. Don't resent being alone. That may be concentrated time from God, but it's never enjoyable when you're in a trial. But it can be some of the most developing, deepening, growing experiences, which you wouldn't want to live again, but you wouldn't trade them for anything. I remember years ago when I was a single man in a missionary location in the south part of the Philippines. I'd broken up a relationship with another gal, and it devastated me, and I was in the South Pacific Island and just wondering what was I doing there, ministering, trying to figure out where God was going to guide my life. I was 24, 25. And I remember sitting there in this back room of a church in Davao City and listening to the radio broadcast. An American preacher was preaching through the book of Acts where Paul had been in prison. And he just stopped there and he says, "You know what? Tonight you may be somewhere in the world where you're all by yourself. And you're not sure what's going to happen to you, but there be God." I've never forgotten that. And by the way, within a month I met Jackie. That's no guarantee for that, but I just do the timing because I had no idea about what was going to happen. Who knows where God is steering you? You're just in a crisis now. It's dark. Jesus has not yet come. He's letting you be shaken around. But trust him all the more during your isolation. That seems to be a common pattern. Queen Esther was all by herself when she faced the king of Persia, the power of the world at that time, and asked him to save her people from genocide. God was with her. But in that moment, she was just by herself. Incredible bravery. Deep in trust in the Lord can increase fear. Look at verse 19. When they had rowed 3 or 4 miles, they saw Jesus walking on the sea, coming near the boat, and they were frightened. Needless to say, they're frightened. I got a couple of quotes from Herman Ritterbos and his great commentary on John. Here's one. It's the fear that fills a person confronted with the revelation of God or the divine, or in general with the supernatural. A fear that apparently also prevents the disciples from immediately recognizing Jesus in the approaching figure, for they had never learned to know him in that way, and thus in that place, in a horrendous situation, had not expected him at all. Yeah, I think that's a scary thing. In fact, other gospel writers say they thought it was a ghost. They didn't just say, "Hey, here comes Jesus, all right." Then I don't think that way. They have no idea who it is. God is coming to them, but they don't know it. They just see some figure, and he's not running at them. He's walking. You know, as if, yeah. That's an amazing thing. Jesus is like, "Hang on, guys, I'm coming. No, there's no word. He's not calling to them. He's not even running at him. I don't know if waves are splashing at him. He's just kind of pushing it aside. But it says he's walking toward them. He's coming to them. No hurry. Unexpected. He hasn't shown himself like that. He multiplied bread. And then I was, wow, I can't explain that. But this freaks me out. Guys don't walk on water. Storms affect him. He's not falling down, swimming at him. He is walking on top, and it scares the life out of me. And you know, when you're in a crisis, you don't forget it. And when God meets you in your valley of the shadow of death, and he's near you, you don't forget those times. Exactly. Don't forget it. For Jesus comes to you, even if you don't expect him to show up in that way. We often have expectations and sometimes boxes that we put God in. He only works in this particular way. And then when he goes outside that box and shows up, we have no explanation. And yes, it causes fear, uncomfortableness. You're not as much in control of life as you might think you are. Everybody's going to go through a crisis. It's not to scare you. It's just to alert you that God has not abandoned you. Now, I want to finish up with two more that I think are marvelous. Deep in trust in the Lord brings reassurance. Look at verses 20 and 21. But he said to them, "It is I. Do not be afraid." Then they were glad to take him in the boat. And just stop right there. Yeah, I'll bet they were. He identifies himself. They can't believe it. They're fearful because something's coming at them. And suddenly it's not the storm. They're seeing this figure that's walking through him. I don't know if it's dark and he's glowing or what, how they see it. But they can't recognize him. And then he calls out to them. He doesn't tell them ahead of time. They're frightened. And when he gets close enough, then he says, "Calm down. It's me. I'm here." I'm here. We didn't know where you were. Yes, get in the boat. Look in Ritterboss, make something that I want to camp on. But by saying that this Jesus also describes his coming and appearance as a divine epiphany, and this occurs in a context, and that is where the emphasis lies in this self-revelation, that should convince them that, catch this, in virtue that the glory given to him by God, no darkness was too deep, waves too high, or sea too wide for him to find them and be with them in the midst of the tumult. No day is too dark for Jesus to find you. No storm is going to be too impossible for God to find you. You're looking for God. Don't worry about it. He's finding you. I'm all by himself. He knows where you are. He's coming. He will find you. Whoa. Never forget that. God will find you. Not in a sense of accusation, but in a sense of a rescue. He will come to you. I think of this movie I saw not too long ago about all these soccer players from Thailand who got trapped in a cave. No spoiler alert, but it'll keep you on the edge of your seat. True story. They went cave exploring, a storm hit, and they threatened to be drowned, really, because they couldn't make their way out and all the waves came in were trapped. But somehow, through rescue teams, they found them. Incredible how they were able to do what was seemed to be an impossible rescue mission. You're in the middle of a sea. No one's going to come out to get you in a boat. They're going to get in the same storm. How in the world? There's no one. It's dark. No one can even know you're there. But somehow Jesus finds them, and he gets into the boat. God will give you reassurance because he knows what you can deal with. He knows how much you can handle. I have to go back to the hedge that Satan complains about Job. I can't get to him. You placed a hedge around him. Remove that and I can destroy him. And God lowers the hedge and says, don't take his life. But I thought, wow, there's a protection force. And if God lowers the force so that the enemy can bring attacks, so that crisis can come, there's a certain amount that I know that I can deal with. 1 Corinthians 10:13 tells us about he will not allow you to deal with more temptation than you can handle. So there's a sensitivity that if God is allowing a storm, if he's allowing a crisis to occur, I must be able to deal with it, and he will find me in that. And I can take reassurance because this is what Jesus is doing with the disciples that he cares so much about, and we're his disciples. And he will find you in your crisis, and he will give you a word of reassurance. That's when you learn to trust him. Even if there doesn't seem to be any resolution immediately at hand. It's still dark. The storm's still going. We still could capsize. And all of a sudden, there he is. And it's frightening at first, but he brings reassurance. And then lastly, there's deepened trust in the Lord that leads to provision. I find John's account interesting. It says at the end of verse 21, and immediately the boat was at the land to which they were going. What do you mean immediately? How did it get there? Other accounts will talk about Peter walking on water or the storm being stilled. It doesn't say the storm ends here. It just says suddenly they're at land. Crisis is over. They got to their destination. I'm thinking, what, do they suddenly like have, you know, jets and just fly across and get there? Or did the land suddenly come this way? I don't know. It doesn't tell us. It just, Jesus gets in the boat. Oh, here we are. How did we get here? Maybe as he's walking, he's pushing the boat along. I don't know. It calls for speculation. Jesus gets into the boat, and the crisis is over. You still have the Lord. Where were you in the middle of the storm? I was coming. But I can't prevent all the storms in life from hitting you. Parents, we can't prevent difficulties from our children. We can't be around them all the time, and that's not healthy for them. We can't bail them out of every crisis. They have to learn to trust in God just as we have to learn to trust in God. So therefore, there's times of which you entrust them because they may have their own capsizing crisis when you can't be there. And they need to learn to trust the same God that you're learning to trust. It just becomes a whole different way of which I'm helping someone to trust, but I'm now trusting by helping them to trust. My crisis is releasing them, knowing that you are caring for them. I don't know about you today. Maybe there is a problem that is like feeding the 5,000, and you're like Philip trying to figure out how many denarii do I have to come up with and to deal with this and this and that. And Jesus already knows the solution. He's just testing you. It's a conundrum, but it's not necessarily life-threatening. And then there's the deepening ones where your life may be on the line, where something is far beyond just counting money. This is a serious thing, and I don't know where God is, and he's not coming to me immediately, and it's still dark, and there's a storm. That's the walking on the water story John wants you to hear. From the disciples' perspective, and the walking on the water is not cool. It is terrifying. And so that's how they're learning from one test into the other how to trust in Jesus. The disciples are going to not just be given the easy road. They're given some intensive training so that when Christ goes to the cross, so that when he goes away and you have Roman guards that are threatening you, now what are you going to do? They don't seem to ever leave the trials and the tests. God gives them brand new ones. How about you today? And how has God brought you through past crises? Are they things that rather than getting embittered, you become deeper and more tenderized in your heart towards God? Is he more precious to you because of the way in which he is still with you and helped you? Or are you becoming harder because you're angry that he didn't come sooner or didn't remove it in the timing that you wanted? Sometimes people do that. Don't let that happen. Don't let life harden you. Let God soften you as you walk through life in whatever circumstance. This won't be the last crisis the disciples face, but it is a very real one that involves their profession, involves a skill, and now suddenly they're out of control. Maybe today is the day you say, okay, yeah, I'm in the middle of something, and I'm going to trust God, even if I'm not sure when he's coming or how he's going to rescue. It doesn't take long for the problem to go away. It just takes for the presence of God and to see him and to be reassured. Let's pray. Father, I thank you that you allow not just difficult situations to arise in our life. You allow crises, things which emotionally affect us because it's dangerous or because it is unexpected. It shows what's going on within our hearts. It shows what we're made of or what you're doing. And so, Father, when you allow these things, let us hold on. You continue to hold on to us. I pray for my brothers and sisters today, whether they're watching from a distance or nearby. I pray, Father, for your grace upon them, for your strength for each moment, for your guidance, whether in good times or in storms, that you will still be showing yourself to be Lord. And whether you multiply bread or walk on water, you are the God of all creation. We praise your name in Jesus' name. Amen.